The topic for tonight is the four foundations of mindfulness. This is part of my Back to Basics series. It's a teaching that's very important in Theravada Buddhism, which is basically what we practice here. The key document that lays out how to practice mindfulness is called the Satipatthana Sutta. And there'll be a quiz on that after the talk. This sutta, or teaching, was compiled after Buddha's death from several of the talks that he gave on the subject. Satipatthana is also the title of a book by Anallio on the Four Foundations. And he translates that word in Pali, Satipatthana, to mean direct path. And it's the direct path to enlightenment or nibbana. The intention of this sutta is for monastics to devote their lives to achieving nibbana. And it's pretty clear in the sutta that that's what it's for. In it, the Buddha says that if the practice laid out in it is diligently followed for 7 years, you're guaranteed to achieve nirvana. And then he says, okay, it could be 6 years, or five, or four, or it could be months, or actually weeks will do the trick. So I ask you, are you not interested in reaching nirvana?
2 weeks.
It's entirely possible. And along the way, there's steadily less clinging and suffering if you practice mindfulness. I've heard many contemporary teachers talk about the four foundations of mindfulness without ever mentioning the Satipatthana Sutta. And I understand the reasons. I was tempted to do that myself, but I just didn't feel that it was fair to you or to this really important sutta, even though it can get pretty complicated and pretty dense. I've studied it many, many times, and I still discover new things each time I do. To me, the most important thing that's often left out when people talk about the four foundations is the way that we're meant to practice with each of these objects. And they are the body, something called feeling tone or vedana, mind states, and dharma. Our approach to these four foundations is another example of how we become something by just being it. It reminds me of the physical therapy that I've been doing, where I'm working the muscles that I need to do what I want without pain. So, in other words, while we're focusing our attention on, for example, the body and the breath, we do it this way. And there are four elements to the method And they are diligently, clearly knowing, mindful, and without desire or discontent. Diligently means with an effort, but an effort that's balanced, not too much, not too little. And when you find that balance, it's actually very pleasant. It's probably why people come back to meditation, because they find the balance and things relax. They get easy, and it feels good. So then clearly knowing means that unguarded, accepting awareness that I refer to in the meditation instructions. It allows us to see and to understand what is experienced, because we're not trying to push it away or go after it. We're just letting it be what it is. And we have the awareness, the freedom of awareness, to understand what it is. The mindful aspect of this is the mental exercise of integrating the information that has been taken in to this open awareness through our effort. So we not only allow it to come in and we understand it, understand what it is, we kind of integrate the whole thing and get a fairly complete picture of what we're experiencing. Again, without desire or discontent. Acceptance. And that's such a key element of all Buddhist practice. Now I'm going to talk about what these foundations are. I've listed them. Body, Vedana, mind, and Dharma. And it starts with the body, just as my meditation instructions did, trying to ease you into the body. And I can't emphasize enough that this is first. This is the first for beginners. It's the first for seasoned practitioners. All of the foundations can be practiced together, but it's essential, especially for beginners, to start with the body. And for all practitioners to have skill in being aware of it. You know, to put it bluntly, few people in Western culture really live in their bodies. There's a well-known book that I can't remember the title of or the author of, but it starts out with the sentence that so-and-so lived about 18 inches above and to the left of his body. And that's pretty much where most of us live. I think the people in this room a little less than most others, but it's definitely a pitfall of living in our culture. It's as if our bodies are these robots that are run by our minds. But being inside the body and perceiving the world from and through it is crucial in what Buddha calls knowing the truth of what is. Because what we're doing otherwise is we're living in delusions that are created by perceiving everything through the medium of our habitual thinking. If we're not in our bodies, we're in a delusion. And that comes out of our always being in the mind, chattering away. So as our practice is concerned, once we're in the body, then we focus on the breath and gradually include the other aspects of the body and then the other three foundations. And I checked the clock, and in fact, I don't have time to really go into the other aspects of the body, but the sutta does, in sometimes gruesome detail. I'll just give you a quick overview. The purpose is to break the identification that we have with the body as ourselves. Even though we live, 18 inches up here, we look in the mirror and we think we're looking at ourselves. So the sutta says, no, look at it both inside and outside. And of course, we live in a world of mirrors. We know what other people see when they look at us. We're very familiar with the outside. So we need to develop what it's like to be on the inside. And then there are the various postures and actions, such as sitting, lying down, walking, doing chores, the way we spend time on retreat. And then it gets kind of gruesome. It talks about the parts of the body, like the muscle tissue, the connective tissue, the various fluids, the pus, the things that you see on television. Especially CSI, that used to be the best way. Buddha told people to go sit in a charnel ground. We don't have to do that. We've got modern TV. So the second foundation is, I've called it Vedana. That's the Pali word for what's often called feeling tone. In a Dharma talk I gave recently called The Roots of Suffering, I talked a lot about how this feeling tone grows into the cause of our suffering. But, it's just this little spark that comes from our interaction with the world. And what it grows into is this inferno of craving and dukkha, suffering. And those sparks are completely beyond our control. It's very, very difficult to notice that mind moment when Vedana comes into play. So what the heck is it? Thank you, Rebecca, for finally getting to the point. Vedana is that we like it, or we don't like it, or, we're neutral about it. We don't really care. In fact, sometimes it just bores us, and we space out. So if we do not examine our responses to events, then that's when it grows. It's this perfectly natural thing that happens. But if we continue to be unaware of it as, say, a preference turns into a prejudice, which turns into a desire and a craving, the next thing we know, it's really causing us trouble in our lives. In other words, our experience is always colored by this feeling tone. It's like what's called a color cast on a photograph. you used to put a filter on the lens of the camera, and now you just go to Photoshop and get a little heavy-handed moving the slide over to blue or red or whatever. What you get is that pleasant feeling leads to greed. We just want more and more of it. And the unpleasant can go all the way over to hatred. And the neutral, that spacing out, goes to delusion. And these are the three roots of suffering. So for these reasons, Vedana comes right after getting familiar with the body and recognizing that it's not you. And also that the fact that you like or don't like something isn't you either. It's this thing that you can only control by not letting it grow. And you can control that. It's much easier to control it early on, as any addict will tell you, than it is when it's become a full-grown addiction. As Analia does, I want to stress that not all pleasant feelings are bad. And the ones that we're not clinging to, you know, are fine. And Buddha declared in a couple of places of the Buddhist literature that he lived in joy. One enduring benefit of concentration practice is that it often involves a lot of joy and very intense pleasure. And even though that itself, it's impermanent, my experience has been that it made joy and loving kindness more available in daily life. Those are definitely parts of living on this path, metta and joy. The third foundation of mindfulness is the mind. This is where we don't need a mirror at all. We can just observe what the mind is creating. And it creates a lot. You may have noticed that I refer to the five physical senses. Well, in Buddhism, there's a sixth sense, and that's the mind. That's the other sixth. Actually, it's often much more than half of what we are aware of that comes from the mind itself. And so it's kind of a good idea to be aware of it, to have that spacious awareness that can see not only what we're thinking, but can see the margins around what we're thinking and hold the perspective that it isn't us. It isn't all of reality. It's just this thought that has arisen and is running its course, and then it'll pass away. And again, it's great that we started out with not identifying with the body, because the practices with the mind in this third foundation are, again, they're four monastics geared to helping them break that identification with the mind and the things that it produces. So the process includes close examination of various mind states. For example, desire, dislike, anger, regret, sadness, the emotions. In the Satipatthana Sutta, it's a list of, I can't remember if it's six or eight of these states of mind. that the monks and nuns are supposed to work through. For lay people, I think it's adequate. It's quite enough, actually, that we think of it in terms of thought, emotion, mood, attitude, assumptions, things like that. And there are two ways that practicing with them works to weaken their power over us. We take these mind states very personally and identify them so closely that it creates this delusion that that's us. I am what I believe, for one thing, my attitudes, my assumptions, my values. I am what I feel. If that's not me, then why do I feel so strongly about this? So it's a strong delusion. It takes some antidoting, and it's dispelled really just by over and over watching these attitudes, assumptions arise, cause trouble, and then pass away. And we see their impermanent nature. We also see the kernel of suffering that they contain. And if we keep doing this practice, we see it over and over. And as we keep watching it happen again and again, that influence that it has over us and our conduct begins to wane. It's like seeing that thoughts are just thoughts. We gain insight into the sources of our hang-ups and can completely uproot them. The fourth foundation is Dharma. And teachers and writers have different ways of presenting this foundation. When not specifically teaching about the Satipatthana Sutta, most of us kind of punt because the Dharma in the Sutta is several sets of sometimes hard to understand teachings. So here's what I think it's helpful to know. The Sutta starts, and so should we, with the five hindrances. Has everybody heard that term before? Well, I'll tell you what they are. It's the first is desire. The second is aversion. The third is that the energy is too high. The fourth is that it's too low. And the fifth is doubt in the practice itself or in the way you're doing it. And these five hindrances show up in our meditation and hinder it all the time. The first big step is just spotting them. And then it's like halfway between meditation and contemplation. The mind just notes low energy by very simply labeling it, sleepy, or high energy, restless. That's all. Not rocket science. It's just like that practice of noting when we find that we're lost in thought. And we go, thinking. Just some label that's very easy to do. Just noticing your experience and identifying it without, for example, going into an analysis of what sloth and torpor even means. Sloth and torpor are low energy. This technique of noting continues into much higher states of concentration, where it's usually said that thinking just falls away. Well, that means discursive thought, the sort of chatter of the mind or analysis. Like, well, what is sloth? Is that related to the animal? Just this recognition, very light touch of thinking. No matter how refined our awareness becomes, there's always some recognition of what our experience is. Otherwise, you're probably asleep. Now, just so that I've done my job here, let me identify the other dharmas in the fourth foundation. The five aggregates, the six sense spheres, the seven awakening factors, and the Four Noble Truths. These are the ones that really break down the products of the mind that we tend to identify with. The Four Noble Truths come last in this progressive scheme, and they're usually the first thing that's taught to beginning students.
Why is that?
There's a reason for that. Thank you, Bonnie. In their deceptive simplicity, the Four Noble Truths are the alpha and omega of the Dharma. And in actual practice, they're very deep and complex. They carry us all the way through at least one lifetime. That's why they're noble. So what's the take home from all of this academic stuff? That the Dharma is a rich, nuanced body of concepts and practices designed to help us end our suffering and others while we're at it. But it's not inaccessible. Take each step when it's the next step for you. You know, I mentioned that the four foundations can be practiced pretty much in order, but start with the body. You can do the four foundations all at one time or one at a time. Just start with the body. And you'll probably find yourself going back to some teachings often, each time mining them a little bit deeper. And I like to go back to basics every so often for a sense of how things fit together and to clear up any mysteries that I think may be hidden in the Dharma. What you need next is entirely within your grasp. Thank you.